Paris and Riyadh going back and forth, is that there may be a move towards willingness to recognize Palestine as a state. But I think the other half of that equation, which is what France and other global north countries are pushing for, is for these Arab countries to recognize Israel as a state. And I think these kinds of soft measures or carrots being offered to Israel are going to be rejected. Israel will pocket these kinds of recognition coming from states like Saudi Arabia and still make no meaningful progress towards a Palestinian state. Benjamin Netanyahu, over the last decade, could not be clearer in saying time after time after time that there will be no Palestinian state ever. He said that as recently as 2 months ago, directly to President Macron, saying that the path that Macron is following in pushing for a Palestinian state in the heart of Jewish land is folly and it will never happen. I don't know how much clearer Netanyahu can be telling the global north that he has no designs, no plans, no vision, no path to be taken for a two-state solution, which is what the international community, particularly the global north, is hanging its star on. As long as the international community and the global north in particular keeps on talking about a two-state solution as it is disappearing in front of our eyes,
it's dead.
This is Israel's sweet spot, if you like. It means that somehow the hope or expectation of the two-state solution is still possible, even as there's now 360 Israeli settlements throughout East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and 740,000 settlers has long ensured that that is impossible. But it still keeps this hope alive, which means there's no meaningful pressure on Israel to keep adding another 20 to 25,000 settlers a year in occupied territory. We've had a statement recently by Antonio Guterres saying that hope is rapidly fading for a two-state solution. Back in 2013, John Kerry, then the U.S. Secretary of State, said, "I'm going to launch this new peace initiative because the door for a two-state solution is going to be open only for the next 12 to 18 months, and then after that it's shut, given the rapid growth of Israeli settlements." Even Resolution 2334 from the Security Council, which we talked about, said in December 2016 about the urgent need to salvage, that was his words in the resolution, salvage the possibility of a two-state solution. If leading figures in the global north and in international diplomacy are already saying this is dead or it's now receiving its last rites, why should we continue to expect that a two-state solution is still possible? If the global north had followed the resolutions that it helped to adopt back in the 1980s about trying to preserve a pathway to ending Israeli occupation, we wouldn't be here 45 years later, talking about the obituary of a two-state solution. But that's what I'm afraid we have to turn to.
How do you imagine the war coming to an end, Michael, and the occupation coming to an end? Do you see it going on indefinitely with no end in sight, or do you see it ending somehow? And how do you imagine it ending? Is it going to end through this kind of slow, gradual process? Or will some tectonic event happen, some remarkable event or sequence of events, perhaps precipitated by an individual leader like, heaven forbid, Donald Trump or someone else, or the European Union in unanimity? They can't achieve a unanimity, but how do you see it ending?
Sure, and those are two related but separate questions. How is a ceasefire going to be brought about? Only if, in one of his saner moments, Donald Trump says this is enough. And who knows what will happen as a result of his trip this week to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states? Will he wind up, listening hard enough to what these Gulf states might be saying and say this, that the Israeli war on Gaza has to be brought to an end. Israel has planned for a major military offensive in Gaza. It's holding off until after Donald Trump finishes his trip to Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE. But whether or not that would wind up resulting in the U.S. putting sufficient pressure on Israel to wind up ending it remains to be seen. And I'm afraid it's probably going to be only when the United States decides that one too many red lines has been crossed by Israel regarding that, that there will be a ceasefire. As to the issue of whether or not there's going to be Palestinian self-determination, that's a harder question to be able to say, because I suspect that once a ceasefire is achieved, I think the attention of the global north will drift away. And they'll figure they put enough pressure on Israel to bring about the ceasefire, but there'll be no meaningful path to Palestinian self-determination. You know, I'm a skeptic as to whether a two-state solution will can ever come about, given the intensity of these Israeli settlement in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. So then the question becomes, what else might be the future for Israel and Palestine? And unless the only future that is consistent with international law, that is consistent with morality and justice, would then be a one-state solution where Palestinians and Jews live in a single state with democratic constitution, democratic government, and equal rights for all. That's the only other way. As an alternative to a genuine two-state solution, which looks like it's disappearing.
And of course, the greatest seismic shifts and revolutions are shifts in thinking and in frames of mind and philosophies. And, you know, we're in this situation today because international law has been completely untethered from the negotiation geopolitical process. It has no bearing. None whatsoever. The International Court of Justice has ruled that the occupation is unlawful, and it's ruled that Israel's assault on Gaza is arguably, plausibly genocidal. It may rule that Israel has been or is committing genocide in Gaza in, you know, next year, in 2 years, or 3 years from now. But if it does, when and if it does, it'll mean nothing, I would say, because no one will do anything about it. And so it's the fact that international law has been totally detached. If everything had been based on international law from the start, if it were now, like this, it would be things would be resolvable immediately.
Look, you know, even if there's a ceasefire, you know, then you think the monumental path ahead of us to try to achieve Palestinian self-determination, first and foremost, would be the reconstruction of Gaza. You know, Gaza is a lunar wasteland now. It reminds us of what pictures we've seen from Berlin or Dresden in 1945. How do you wind up reconstructing that? You know, there has to be obviously huge international support with Israel excluded from the determining the future of Gaza with regards to that. The other aspect of this is something. This phrase that many of us have learned from the disability rights movement: "Nothing about us without us." And that same thing has to be true with respect to the Palestinians. The reconstruction of Gaza has to be Palestine focused, Palestine centered, with Palestinians as a significant part of the decision making of how Gaza gets reconstructed. The same thing is true with respect to the achievement of the end of Israeli presence in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. That has to be Palestine centered as well. And it's hard to imagine, given what the state of things where they are right now, and this extraordinary military, political, economic superiority that Israel enjoys over the Palestinians, of how we wind up getting to a point where both sides treat each other as equals into trying to determine some kind of compassionate future, past compassionate peace, and a prosperous joint future for all of them. That seems like a pipe dream, but you know, this is how most other extraordinary conflicts ended. This is how, you know, the Iron Curtain came down in the early 1990s. This is how apartheid South Africa wound up coming. 2 or 3 years before 1990 and 1991, no one would have thought that was going to be achievable in any time in the future, let alone perhaps even in their lifetimes. So we can hope to dream with respect to Israel and Palestine, but we also have to keep our feet firmly on the ground because of the extraordinary advantages Israel enjoys, which is not likely to give up, including, you know, its military industrial complex and this very prosperous alliance that it has with the United States.
Are you teaching now at Western University, Michael? Are you teaching classes, talking about the law, talking about international law?
No, but I did teach, I co-taught a course this winter at another law school in Toronto on Israel, Palestine, and international law. And that's the first time I've taught such a course. And that was an eye-opening and enjoyable experience for me. We had a number of very gifted students in the course.
These were law students.
Law students, second and third year law students. And we went through, obviously, the multiple strands of international law that winds up governing the relationship between Israel and Palestine. We started from the turn of the 20th century right up until today, and we went through all of the major political issues seen through the lens of international law, such as the fate of Jerusalem, the settlements, the refugees. What is the future of Israel and Palestine? Is it one state? Is it two states? Is it some form of confederation? It was a really rich and enjoyable experience that I think brought students much closer to understanding how international law views a conflict or an occupation or a domination such as Israel and Palestine, and ways, creative ways in which to resolve this consistent with justice and international law.
And was there any dissonance or friction in the course of these conversations?
Sure, there were debates within the within each of the classes. There were students or people who were taking the course who, you know, saw the struggle or the domination through predominantly an Israeli lens. But, you know, in many ways, I think that only contributed to the richness of the discussions in the class, because I think you only either change your mind or you become deeper in your convictions, original convictions, when you're challenged. And being challenged, I think even if you think you're on the right side of righteousness and international law, that can only help you intellectually grow as a person and grow as a thinker when you hear the other side being explained to you.
Michael Link, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
David, as always, a great pleasure. Thank you for continuing to host these podcasts, and I wish you the very best.
Michael Link is Emeritus Professor of Law at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Between 2016 and 2022, Link served as the 7th UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the territories occupied by Israel since 1967. To read more about Michael Link and the Special Rapporteur position, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Learning a new trade and being the new person on a job site can be hard, especially if there's nobody else there who looks like you. Native American women working in solar may know the feeling well.
They might be the only woman, they might be the only brown person in their group of installers that they'll be working with.
Alicia Hayden is with Red Cloud Renewable, a Native-led nonprofit based in South Dakota. The group runs free solar workforce training programs, including one specifically for Native American women. For graduate Jacinta Goggles, learning alongside other Native women created camaraderie.
There's a certain kinship you feel, and I think that ability to be so comfortable with each other very quickly was a huge factor in all of our success because all of us wanted each other to succeed.
And Hayden says participants leave the program connected with other participants and with mentors already working in the field.
In their cell phone, they have the names of 15 new friends they just made, some of which are Native American women who have been working in this industry for 10 years that are just a phone call or a text away.
So even if they're the only Native woman on a job site, they can feel supported, connected, and less alone. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.